This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 17, 2002, from the Chiapas Independent Media Center in Mexico. I'm Deepa Fernandez. A retrial to occur for NYPD officer Charles Schwartz in the police torture case. Bush releases broad strategy for homeland security that includes 1 million civilian spies, military ties with Mexico, and Navy use of low-power sonars that kill whales. And in Afghanistan, a dramatic rise in the number of young women burning themselves alive. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. This morning, Spanish military forces evicted Moroccan soldiers from a soccer field-sized island in the Mediterranean. David Oancia has more from Spain.
President Aznar said the eviction took place without injury and in consultation with the king, opposition leaders, and NATO. The six gendarmes had occupied the 5/100 of a square mile-sized island last Thursday and raised the Moroccan flag. Spain first laid claim to the island in the 17th century, but Morocco claims Perejil is part of the North African state. At heart of the problem are mounting tensions between the two nations. Morocco has claimed that Spain has been ignoring the repatriation of Ceuta and Melilla, two small Spanish enclaves on the Moroccan coast. Escalating tensions between the countries surround illegal immigration, fishing rights, and the independence of Western Sahara's Sahrawi people. Last October, the Moroccan government called back its ambassador, and the situation has deteriorated since. Yesterday, Madrid also recalled its ambassador from Rabat. For Free Speech Radio News, this is David Oancia in Madrid.
Two former El Salvadoran generals, now retired and living in South Florida, have been on trial in federal court for 2 months in West Palm Beach for allegedly ignoring the violence committed by the soldiers they commanded. Yesterday, one of those former generals denied any firsthand knowledge of the alleged torture of civilians, refuting earlier testimony from a doctor who said the general had watched as he was brutally interrogated 20 years ago in their homeland. Mitch Perry has more from Tampa.
Carlos Eugenio Vitas Casanova was head of the El Salvadoran National Guard from 1979 to 1983. Jose Guillermo Garcia was defense minister during that same period. Last month, as the latest trial got underway, one of the plaintiffs pointed the finger at Vitas Casanova. Although blindfolded, Dr. Juan Romagosa Arce said he recognized the general's voice from when he visited a cell at National Guard headquarters while Romagosa was being tortured. But yesterday, Vitas Casanova said he had never interrogated anyone in his life. Under the 1992 Federal Torture Victims Protection Act, the plaintiffs need only to convince the 8-person jury that Vitas Casanova and Garcia knew their troops were torturing civilians, but did nothing to stop them. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Women in labor unions are organizing and asking for legislation to protect their unique health needs. John Hamilton of the Workers' Independent News Service reports.
The Coalition of Labor Union Women wants health insurance companies to cover the cost of contraceptives. Carolyn Jacobson of the Coalition's Contraceptive Equity Project says that unlike other medicines, birth control isn't often covered by private insurers.
Recent study of private insurance found that 49% of large group plans don't routinely cover any contraceptive method.
Recent rulings by a federal court and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission have forced some insurers to pick up the cost of birth control, but Jacobson warns that laws are needed to make such coverage universal. 19 states already have such laws on the books, but a proposed federal law has yet to reach the floor of Congress. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
One plan for a Homeland Security Department hopes to cut security for government workers. Shannon Leocata reports from D.C.
The Bush administration wants to reorganize an estimated 170,000 employees of the soon-to-be-created Homeland Security Department with fewer rights than other civil employees have. The proposal will make it easy to fire these government employees. Republican leaders say that they just want more latitude to manage. But Beth Moten, the legislative director of the American Federation for Government Employees, says the administration is removing an important worker protection.
The problem with the administration's bill is that they leave open the door to fire people without any sort of appeal right. They've blown the whistle or if they're they're being discriminated against are for political reasons.
Many Democrats fear that the administration's rules for the department are a downfall for civil service rights across the board and that the proposal will not pass through Congress as it stands. Republicans feel that the department requires flexibility and that these rights can be put on the back burner for the sake of Homeland Security and the so-called war on terrorism. For Free Speech Radio in Washington, this is Shannon Lee Okada.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
After 6 days of deliberation, a jury in the retrial of the Abner Louima torture case found former New York police officer Charles Schwarz guilty of perjury yesterday. Schwarz was convicted twice before in the assault of Abner Louima that occurred 5 years ago. Prosecutors in the case say there will be a retrial, but some activists and Louima supporters say this is a partial verdict in a battle against police brutality that's far from won. From New York City, Jeff Brady has this report.
A Brooklyn jury found former New York police officer Charles Schwarz guilty of lying when he said he did not lead Abner Louima down the hall to the police station bathroom, where he was brutally assaulted. However, the jury did not have a verdict for another perjury charge and of two civil rights charges against Schwarz. Those charges include allegedly conspiring to use excess force against Louima and helping to hold him down while former police officer Justin Volpe sodomized Louima with a broken broomstick. Prosecutors say they will prepare a retrial on the other charges against Mr. Schwarz. Brooklyn U.S. Attorney Alan Weingard calls the jury's verdict a victory. During the press conference, Weingard did not indicate how soon a retrial would be considered. Nicholas Hayward Sr. with the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality and the Criminalization of a Generation says Mr. Schwarz clearly lied in his prior testimony and says that he thinks Schwarz was more involved in the torture of Abner Louima than just walking him down the hall.
You are not going to shove something in a man's rectum and that man is not going to be screaming and yelling and you are not going to hear what is being said. I mean, the officer already testified that Abner Louima was led from the front desk with his pants down to his knees. That right there, they were officers who were presently seeing this happening. If you consider yourself or believe yourself to be a good officer, when you see some civilian's rights being violated, you're supposed to take action right there.
Throughout the legal saga, Schwarz has maintained that he was at the front desk or at the patrol car while Justin Volpe committed the assault. Volpe and two other officers, Thomas Weiss and Thomas Bruder, were convicted of obstruction of justice. In a taped phone conversation of Justin Volpe speaking to his father from prison, Volpe expresses bitterness about allegedly taking the fall for another officer.
I want to speak to my lawyers. They better get their asses up. If they think that I'm going to be the other guy's night and shining armor, you know what I'm saying? They think that we're going to hope for the best 10 years down the road. I don't know. This other guy here, he's going home, and I'm going to be rotting in these places. I want my lawyers up. I'm sitting here in a f***ing empty f***ing room, and I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? That other asshole's home. I want my f***ing time cut. But if I miss the boat in the next coming weeks, it might not be for a long, long time. I'm at the point where if I know I'm not getting my time cut, I want to go back tonight. If they think I'm falling on the sword again for nothing, they're out of f***ing mind.
Not everyone considers a juror's verdict to be a victory. In a press conference yesterday, the Reverend Al Sharpton says that only two of the 12 jurors were black and that racism is to blame for the jury's failure to deliver a guilty verdict on all charges. Jonathan Hutto with Amnesty International says the jury does have an effect on high-profile, racially charged cases.
Our research has shown, particularly take a state like Philadelphia, you know, where they had the real harsh brutality, and they still have brutality there, but particularly I'm talking about during the Rizzo administration, you know, the whole MOVE era there in Philly. I mean, prosecutors were trained in how to knock off black jurors. We see it throughout America. So, yes, I think the selection of a jury is very important, and I think the jury has to reflect the populace of the people. So, yes, jury selection is important. It is very important. Two blacks on a jury in New York City, that has the highest population of African Americans in this country, is not good. That's not a good thing.
October 22nd Coalition Nicholas Hayward, who also became involved with Family Seeking Justice after his son was murdered by a housing police officer in 1994, says there has been little gained in the battle against police brutality. Jonathan Hutto says police brutality and racial profiling with people of color is on the rise.
The only difference between what goes on every day and what happened in Englewood and Oklahoma City is that Englewood, Oklahoma was televised. It was on tape. And so we encourage people, you know, if you got your camcorders on and you see things going on, do exactly what those citizens did in Oklahoma City and in Englewood.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeff Brady in New York.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is recruiting 1 million American civilians to alert the police if they see any suspected terrorist activity. The details have yet to be released, but civil liberties groups are alarmed. In Washington, Joshua Chaffin spoke with the Justice Department this afternoon about what it's calling Operation TIPS.
TIPS stands for Terrorist Information and Prevention System. FEMA is asking millions of truckers, letter carriers, train conductors, ship captains, and utility employees to report any suspicious activity they see in the course of their duties. But anyone can join. The program could encompass as many as 1 in 24 Americans, but today Senator Fred Thompson, who's a member of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, knew little about the program.
Well, I find it hard to fault it. We can set up an arrangement where people feel free to report suspicious circumstances in terms of terrorism. I think that's probably a good thing.
An article about Operation TIPS in an Australian newspaper this week noted the program will result in more civilian spies than East Germany during the communist Stasi era. Again, Senator Fred Thompson.
I don't think the East Germans were reporting each other's terrorist activities on each other. I don't think that's a very good comparison.
The Justice Department spokesperson Barbara Comstock.
This is looking at public places, nothing about going into people's homes or having access to private areas.
It's interesting, the Justice Department is clearly on the defensive on this.
Kit Gage with a civil liberties group called the First Amendment Foundation.
And I think that's, you know, it's correct because unless they're really very specific about the kind of things that they want people to look at and these folks get very good training, you know, I think it's the kind of program that's so prone to abuse and to miss, you know, to sending in information that's completely useless and completely racist.
Gage says law enforcement agencies have historically had problems with racial profiling of criminal suspects. She suspects the problem could be worse in a force of millions of untrained civilian informants. On the issue of training for the tipsters, the Justice Department's Barbara Comstock says only that Operation TIPS is not a membership organization.
What it is, it's based on successful existing non-governmental programs such as Highway Watch, River Watch, Coast Watch, something else that is the concept of Neighborhood Watch, which, you know, millions of Americans are obviously familiar with.
When asked if the Justice Department is concerned that racial profiling might be an issue among the volunteers with Operation TIPS, spokeswoman Barbara Comstock said she had nothing to add and asked that the racial profiling question and her answer not be used on the air. According to the Department of Defense, Operation TIPS will be rolled out at the end of summer or in early fall. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
President Bush yesterday released a 90-page document describing the potential threat of terrorist attacks from al-Qaeda and other extremist groups. Bush also announced his broad strategy for fighting these perceived threats, which among other things includes greater emphasis on a new military command that will take effect on October 1st, called North Command. North Command will, for the first time ever, involve direct military relations between the U.S. and Mexico. The declaration of the new North Command made by Donald Rumsfeld on April 18 contained very little information of what this command will involve. The U.S. Army has many military commands around the world, but has never had a command that was directly designed to protect the territory of the United States. Chiapas-based Ernesto Ledesma of the Center of Political Analysis and Social and Economic Research has been studying the increasing ties between the two countries' military.
Por supuesto que estamos preocupados y ocupados además, ¿no?, con la creación del Comando Norte.
Obviously, we are very worried about the creation of this North Command, mostly because we don't know what it involves or what Mexico's functions will entail with U.S. forces. Will it involve airspace or land operations? And how far will these military ties between the U.S. armed forces with the Mexican government go?
What is known is that the North Command gives the U.S. the green light to use Mexican territory to defend its own territory. Veteran journalist John Ross has been following the increasing military ties between the neighbors.
Clear Rumsfeld and the U.S. ambassador here, Jeffrey Davido, were quick to say this does not mean the integration of the Mexican armed forces in the U.S. armed forces. Other folks that look at this, the way the militaries and the security apparatuses are integrating, is saying that no, that's not true, that this is the beginning of a formation of a Commando America, which we would see, you know, troops from the three countries operating together on the ground against what they defined as being terrorist threats to the U.S.
And in the case of Mexico, these terrorist threats already include insurgent groups like the Zapatistas. Gustavo Castro is a researcher with the Community Action Center of Political and Economic Research in San Cristóbal de las Casas.
Si bien no hay base militar de Estados Unidos en México, sí hay una relación muy estrecha.
So there are no physical military bases in Mexico, but there is a long relationship of some U.S. military personnel in certain areas of the country consulting and advising the Mexican military. One of the primary objectives of the relationship is control over migration and narco trafficking. But one of the big reasons for the ties to the U.S. military is to control the insurgents. The Mexican military continues to create elite forces against insurgents, and this they do with the help of the U.S. military.
Castro's organization has documented the heavy Mexican military presence surrounding indigenous and especially Zapatista communities. And he says that recently U.S. military presence and assistance to the Mexican military has been occurring.
In some indigenous communities here in Chiapas, the community has reported the presence of North American soldiers in military camps training the Mexican soldiers. But these reports have never been made public nor been officially accepted.
Since 1994, Mexico has steadily increased the number of soldiers it sends to the U.S. to be trained. And in the last year, 1,000 soldiers were trained at the School of the Americas. This U.S. help, says Castro, is justified in the post-September 11 climate as necessary to protect U.S. borders. The police then become involved in what has been a stepped-up civilian security control. And as John Ross points out, civilian security also opens up Mexico to the FBI.
Just a couple of months ago, a truck full of cyanide, 7 tons of cyanide, was hijacked in central Mexico, and Fox gave permission to the FBI to operate on Mexican territory, greenlighted them to openly investigate in Mexico. So they've always done it, but it's been sub rosa. It's never been a statement from the top.
Bush's Homeland Security strategy announced today advocates giving the federal government greater authority to deploy the National Guard, which is now under state control, and would be coordinated under the new U.S. North Command. With perhaps the gravest implications for indigenous communities in southern Mexico, the vastly increased U.S. military participation in Mexico is no longer talk. What is occurring now, they say, is the implementation of the integration of security forces, both civilian and military, between the U.S. and Mexico. Another Bush administration proposal to safeguard America against terrorist attacks yesterday cleared the way for Navy use of a powerful low-frequency sonar to identify enemy submarines, a move environmentalists say will lead to increased strandings and deaths of whales. The Gulf of Maine is an important seasonal feeding area for endangered humpback whales, fin whales, and right whales. Fisheries that entangle right whales are required to use risk reduction measures, and the National Marine Fisheries Service regularly issues alerts to shippers to warn of recent right whale sightings near shipping lanes. Right whales have been spotted between April and October. However, this May, the U.S. Navy conducted live bombing exercises near the whale's critical habitat. Emily Bernhard has this report.
100 years ago, East Coast whalers found that a certain species of whale would float as they died, making them easy to catch. The whalers dubbed the species the right whale and hunted them to the brink of extinction where they still hover today. With only 300 animals surviving, the North Atlantic right whale is one of the most endangered species on Earth. On June 10th, the National Marine Fisheries Service spotted the carcass of a right whale calf floating in the Gulf of Maine. While the exact cause of death could not be determined due to decomposition, a government worker contacted the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, and informed them that the Navy had been conducting live bombing exercises in the area.
We can't prove that this calf was decapitated
by a Navy bomb, and we probably will never know the truth. But the fact remains that we have a very unusual injury showing up, a calf without a head. It had a gaping hole in its back, and we had Navy bombing occurring at the time that the calf died in that area.
Kyla Bennett is director of New England Pier.
What is not understandable to me is that they are doing these bombing runs when we have a critically endangered species in the area. I think that is unacceptable, and that can be easily avoided.
John James is director of public affairs at the Brunswick Naval Air Station. He says there's no proof that the giant hole in the whale's back came from a Navy bomb. He notes that the Navy has conducted live bombing exercises in New England waters for decades.
For 40 years, the Navy has been flying over the Gulf of Maine and dropping both live, so-called live weapons, as well as inert ordnance, non-exploding ordnance. And the Navy has and the Air Force have always cleared the area below them. There are hundreds of times more vessels in the Gulf of Maine than there are whales and right whales. We conduct ourselves very, very safely and have never had an incident that we're aware of.
James insists that the Navy takes necessary precautions before conducting the bombing exercises, including aerial surveys at 1,500 feet to make sure that boats and whales are out of the area before they drop the bombs. Last August, the National Marine Fisheries Service commissioned a report urging the station to adopt specific operating procedures to avoid harming right whales, including aerial surveys, consultation with the Coast Guard, and the exploration of alternative bombing ranges. John James insists the Brunswick Naval Air Station has adopted these measures, while the Humane Society says that they have not. In the meantime, the Department of Defense has requested that Congress give the military wide latitude in interpreting and adhering to environmental laws. Again, Kyla Bennett.
Basically, the Department of Defense is saying, you know, trust us, we're good stewards. And I find it very ironic that while they're telling us that we should trust them and while we should give them exemptions to all of these environmental laws so that they don't have to follow them like everyone else in the country does, they're doing something pretty ridiculous, like bombing critically endangered species. It certainly doesn't instill a lot of confidence in me.
The House of Representatives has already passed a bill exempting the military from the Endangered Species Act and some other laws. If the democratically controlled Senate follows suit, the future of the North Atlantic right whale could hang in the balance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Emily Bernhard at WERU in Blue Hill, Maine.
There is a horrifying new phenomenon occurring in Afghanistan where young women burn themselves alive. As Fariba Nawar reports from Herat, the latest case of self-immolation occurred just last week.
The nurse lifted the white sheet over 20-year-old Sana's body. She barely moved. Her features weren't recognizable above the torso. A week ago, Sana took a gallon of cooking gas, threw it over her chest, and lit a match. 40% of her body is recovering from first-degree burns. Her speech is slurred because half of her mouth was burned.
I did it because of my mother-in-law. She fought with me 1,000 times. I couldn't tolerate it anymore. I did it because I had no other choice.
Sana is one of several girls in Herat, a city of 330,000, attempting self-immolation to escape family dilemmas and unwanted marriages. Self-immolation has risen from none last year during the reign of the Taliban to 4 this year under the new government, according to hospital records. No one is able to explain the dramatic rise in numbers, and authorities are addressing what used to be a private issue publicly. Herat Governor Ismail Khan visited the burn unit in the hospital this week to talk to 2 of the patients, and the city's television station dedicated an hour program to understanding and solving the issue Sunday night. The fact the government is taking an active role in resolving the problem shows its urgency. Most women in Afghanistan agree to arranged marriages, which are normally as practical as business contracts. A man's parents proposes to the woman's parents, and then the woman's family investigates the man before saying yes or no to the marriage. But there are many cases where women say no, and their parents or family members force them to marry. Marriage problems and family dilemmas have not worsened since the fall of the Taliban, so it's a mystery as to why so many more women are now reacting and finding self-immolation a way out, despite the taboo of suicide in Muslim and Afghan societies. It is believed by Muslims that an individual goes straight to hell for committing suicide. Roya Hamid, a 24-year-old studying fine arts at Herat University, says women are not aware of their rights and don't know how to communicate with their families. Their desperation, in part, is a result of ignorance.
I would fight back if my parents forced me into a marriage as a second wife. I have a choice because I come from an open-minded family, but even if I didn't, I would find another way. You have to take your rights. No one will give them to you.
But most of the young women who attempt suicide do not want to die. Psychologists here say they just want out of an unfair and unjust situation. They're calling for attention in a society that tells them to be patient and put up with injustice. Parents demand dowries up to $100,000 and sell their daughters to the highest bidder. Those who can afford to pay the dowry normally have more than one wife. The girls live with their husband's extended family and often end up as servants. Mumtaz Abazadeh, a nurse at Herat's main hospital for 12 years, says medical professionals are also playing the role of family therapists and urging parents to seek their daughter's approval in marriage and communicate with them. They also tell the girls to find other solutions to suicide.
These girls are ignorant. They don't think about the fact that marriage is hard work. As soon as something goes wrong, they pour a gallon of gas on themselves. It's a mistake. Don't they consider their children and their own body precious?
Last month, a 14-year-old died after burning herself because her family married her to a 60-year-old man. She lived with him for several months and decided death was better than her life, according to hospital staff. 80% of the victims die, hospital staff say. The incident that leads up to self-immolation is often small, but is reflective of bigger conflict. Sana says she lives with 15 of her in-laws, and her mother-in-law treats her as a servant, always causing problems between her husband and her. The day she burned herself, her mother-in-law accused her of spilling dirty water on their food. She denied the charge, and the two women began shouting. Her husband, Abdel Naim, came and beat both of them to shut them up.
She said, "I'll relieve you of your troubles," and lit the match right in front of me. I threw a blanket on her, changed her clothes, and brought her to the hospital. I told my mother that this was her fault and that we had to put up with it for 3 years, but we would leave her now and live a separate life. I love my wife, but I'm not satisfied with my mother.
Indeed, an explanation of the increase in suicides may be that women are copying each other. Despite the fact that Afghan women are allowed far more freedoms now than during the Taliban era, they work and attend school, the deeper societal gender gap has yet to be tackled. An aid worker says doctors in the villages report families burning their daughters to death if they have been raped in order to escape societal shame. The families blame the death on women, saying they killed themselves because they were mentally ill. Mahbuba Aslami registers patients at the hospital and helps prepare a health program on Herat television and radio. She offers another explanation for the boost in suicide attempts.
During the Taliban, they would find the girl's father and put him in jail without doing any investigation or interviewing the girl. Men couldn't see women then, even in hospital beds. But they would take the father and beat him up. Now they talk to the girl and the family. Maybe the girls feel part of their freedom is the chance to die. We still haven't figured out the reason.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fari Banawa in Herat.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.